Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since George Bush's symbolic bow and thinly veiled threat to the UN last week, the why of waging war on Iraq has been upstaged by the when. But not everyone is on board. Coming up on Point, a conversation with Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham about the motives and marketing of America's war on Iraq. We begin tonight with a look at the political stakes tied to war on Baghdad. With November elections looming, Republicans and Democrats are drawing very careful battle lines around the war. Michael Crowley joins me on the line from Washington, D.C. He's associate editor and Capitol Hill correspondent for The New Republic. Good evening, and thanks for joining us, Michael Crowley.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, what are the two parties' hopes and fears in approaching elections and war with Iraq at the same time?
Well, of course, it's zero sum. The Republican Party's hope, in a purely political sense, mm-hmm. is that we will be debating war first and foremost between now and November, and that voters will go to the polls and make their decisions based on national security issues, because Republicans have an overwhelming advantage. Every single poll shows in terms of which party the public trusts on those issues.
So the national security bandwagon is one that they'd like to ride right through to the elections.
Absolutely, and they'd like to roll it right over the backs of Democrats who fare terribly on those issues and are desperate to get people talking again about Enron, WorldCom, corporate scandal, Social Security, health care. Democrats were really optimistic in a way that folks down here had not seen them in a long time, sort of in the middle of August, early August, when they felt like the national conversation was on those issues, and the subject of war has now really distressed them. They feel like they're not talking about the issues that really draw voters most to their side.
So do they think that the heady push toward war right now means a poorer election performance for them in November?
Well, they are making the argument publicly that they can weather this, that voters are going to vote primarily on pocketbook issues. They call them kitchen table issues, things like the economy, jobs, healthcare, Social Security. They point to the election of the 2001, the example of the 2001 elections. There were some gubernatorial races. There was one in Virginia and New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Democrats won handily in both, and that was just a couple of months after September 11th. They cite those as an example that voters aren't necessarily going to have a knee-jerk reaction to support Republicans when they're thinking about war, although those were gubernatorial races, and I'm not sure that's the best example. But,
and are they still saying that in the last week, Michael Crowley, since President Bush's appearance at the UN and the kind of real head of steam that things have since then?
Well, they still say it publicly, and they say it somewhat a little more half-heartedly privately, and I think privately you're starting to see some of the concern creep in, and you're also starting to see, I think, as evidence of their concern, the assertion that the White House has timed this war debate and politicized the war debate to gain an advantage in the midterm elections. I think that's evidence of the fact that they've grown quite concerned.
You quote Jim Jordan with the Democrat Senatorial Campaign Committee saying, talking about Karl Rove, who he calls General Rove, calling in airstrikes in October.
Yeah.
I guess the notion there that Democrats have feared for a while that the war would be heading into it, or it would be in full swing at election time.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I mentioned that they were feeling optimistic back in August. Jim said that at a briefing for political reporters that I attended early in August, Congress had gone out of session. Democrats thought, we'll have some reporters in, we'll tell them how great things are going, how much voters are really talking about health care and the economy and all these issues that are so good for us. And somebody raised the question, Jim, you know, are you worried that the subject, the conversation might change between now and November? And that's when he made his crack about General Rove. And people kind of laughed nervously and thought, you know, can you really say that? But now I think he is really feeling vindicated. It's not October, but it's close enough. And I think people in the party feel like Karl Rove had to some extent planned it this way.
Michael Crowley, have the Democrats found nothing for them in a debate over the prospect of war in Iraq itself? Have they found no handle there that they can argue to their advantage?
I don't see it. If they have, I haven't seen it, and there are very few people who have. This magazine, The New Republic, wrote a very tough editorial this week castigating the Democrats for essentially trying to dodge the Iraq debate and for failing to come up with a coherent position, even if it's in opposition to going quickly to war. No one is in the party has really articulated a coherent position. The party line right now seems to be, we need to ask more questions, we need more information, which is perfectly appropriate, but there doesn't seem to be any underlying vision on the part of virtually any Democrats. So I would have to say the only upside for this for Democrats right now would be the opportunity for some of these members of Congress to cast votes in support of a war that might sort of affirm their kind of military national security credentials, because that's a big problem for a lot of Democrats. But that's the only thing I see right now.
And what about the announcement we heard just as we came on the air this evening that Iraq has apparently, through Kofi Annan, consented to weapons inspections without condition?
Yeah.
Is this, for the Republicans, is this a victory or is this a problem because it could make going to war more diplomatically complicated?
Well, I just learned about this a few minutes ago, as I think everyone did.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's I haven't thought through the angles. I would say that at first blush, you know, it could be politically speaking, it could be problematic for Republicans because it would seem to affirm what Democrats had been saying, which was go to the UN, make a multilateral case, try to enlist the world community. And at least the first way I've seen this announcement played, it seems to be people saying, you know, this was Iraq seeing the writing on the wall because Bush's UN speech seemed to go over fairly well. So it may actually give the Democrats a kind of I told you so moment, but we really need to see how it plays out.
And see whether it's ultimately welcomed or whether it's seen as another dodge by the Bush White House.
Well, precisely. That's why Republicans never embraced this line in the first place, because the Bush White House and many conservative Republicans are very skeptical that weapons inspections can be effective. And I think there is a very good case to be made that a lot of these, particularly biological weapons, are very, very easy to hide and to conceal. And it's almost impossible to prove that you've hunted them all down and eliminated them.
Michael Crowley, thank you for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Crowley is associate editor and Capitol Hill correspondent for The New Republic. War may be in the air. It may be swaying the UN, the U.S. Congress, and American public opinion. But our guest tonight doesn't buy it. Even now, the Bush administration is simply stupefied by the romance of imperial power, says Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham. And that, he says, is the greatest danger to great powers, and has been since the time of ancient Athens, not to mention the Bay of Pigs and Vietnam. What destroyed an empire in the 5th century B.C. may well be a cautionary tale for the new American empire today. And Lewis Lapham is not afraid to talk about it or write about it, as he has in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Are you ready for this war? Are you ready for dissent over this war? Is this American overreach or is this America's duty? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham, author most recently of a fiery collection of essays entitled Theater of War, and in the current issue of Harper's, The Road to Babylon. Good evening and welcome, Lewis Lapham.
I'm glad to be here, Tom.
It's good to have you. Louis Leffen, there's a lot to talk about tonight, including the news just in at the top of the hour that Iraq has agreed unconditionally to weapons inspections and all the complications that brings in. But take us, if you will, first, back to the analogy that you're drawing in your new essay, The Road to Babylon. You're drawing a parallel between America, 2002, and imperial or powerful Athens in ancient Greece, 415 B.C. What do you see the contemporary power learning from the ancient power? Or the lesson, even if it's not the lesson, even if it's not being learned?
I would hope that the lesson learned is caution. I mean, in 415 B.C., the Athenians find themselves, for the moment, the overruling superior hegemon in the Aegean world. The war with Sparta has been going on for 17 years, but at the moment, the Athenians have won all the battles, and they have the dream that maybe they can extend their power throughout the entire Mediterranean. They can not only conquer the island of Sicily, but extend their sovereignty along the coast of Africa, which was then Carthage, all the way to what was then the Pillar of the Pillars of Hercules, now known as the Straits of Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. So they get carried away with this ambition, and they are told there's a trumped-up pretext for the war, an Athenian colony on the island of Sicily. Comes to Athens and says that we, the Segestans, your allies, fellow Achaean Greeks on the island of Sicily, are being harassed and threatened by the city of Syracuse, and we will be overwhelmed unless you come to our aid. And we promise you treasure. We promise we will pay for the expedition. We will come up with ships and men and horses, and we will be your steadfast ally, and together we will defeat these wretched Syracusans. And the Syracusans have an alliance, tenuous alliance, with Sparta.
And the Athenians bite.
The Athenians bite. There's a debate, and the wonderful thing about Thucydides is that there are two long chapters toward the end of the book.
This is Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian Wars.
Yes, his History of the Peloponnesian Wars, and he goes through the arguments on both sides. And I quote some of those arguments in the piece, and they sound very similar to the argument that I wish there was more of at this point States.
You hear doubters, and this is more than 2,000 years ago, saying even if we conquer Sicily, it's going to be very difficult to govern. And you read others saying, or Thucydides saying, that the few who actually were opposed to the expedition were afraid of being thought unpatriotic if they voted against it and therefore kept quiet.
That's right. There's a loud outcry. Everybody wants on to Sicily. And the advocates for the war have pointed out that Syracuse is a puny enemy, ragtag, no army, as weak as Saddam Hussein, a poor government, people of low character, and that it will be a walk in the park.
But the upshot of that war for the battle and for Athens?
Is catastrophe. The Athenians send the largest fleet ever sent out of a single city in the history of the Greek world, 130 ships outfitted with gilded figureheads and silver shields, and many transport ships bringing grain and corn and horses and soothsayers and so forth. And it's the most splendid expedition ever assembled, and they land in Sicily, and over a period of, I think, a year, managed to destroy the entire fleet and the entire army.
And our time is short before the break, but remind us, Louis Leffen, the consequences of this defeat for great Athens.
It's the end of their empire, because it so weakens them, and that they, again, the war with Sparta picks up. The city loses the reaction against the lost war results in a corrupt oligarchy taking over the role of government from what was once a healthy democracy. So the government of Athens decays.
And in our few seconds before the break, are you seriously suggesting, Lewis Lapham, that the mighty 2002 army of the United States could suffer the same thing? The United States is really up against a potential lethal opponent in Saddam Hussein.
I don't think so much in Saddam Hussein any more than I thought it necessarily that the Greeks thought in the city of Syracuse, but it is the question of what happens over time if we get drawn into Iraq, into the whole of Southwest Asia, into Kurdistan, Kazakhstan, Saudi Arabia,
and all the rest. Lewis Lapham, yeah. We have to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking with Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's. Are you with the president on the path to war with Iraq? Have we had nationally a sufficient debate on war with Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine, who is against war with Iraq, however popular it may be. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Is this a sober, well-considered path we are on to war? Is this war imperial overreach, or is it wise stewardship of global security? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Lewis Lapham, to bring it straight up to date, you write, you say that a stupefied Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld are drawn in by the romance of imperial power, that they speak from within a dream as old as the walls of Troy. What's the dream that you see them in a walking in?
Well, I think it's the same kind of dream that was entertained by Alcibiades in the debate in Thucydides, which is a dream of empire. Sovereign, extending the aegis of America's power, the American way of life, the American economy, however you want to define it, over broad reaches of the world. We call it, you know, hegemony. We call it the world's only superpower. We call it empire. But it strikes me as an imperial purpose.
But more often, we call it democracy. We call it justice. George Bush did last week. We call it international order.
It doesn't strike me the habit of the American government over the last 20-odd years has struck me as being more imperial and more oligarchic in its character than democratic. And we have in this same issue of Harper's Magazine a review of Defense Department policy planning papers going back to 1991, which are written by Cheney and Powell, in which they say flat out that our purpose is the domination of the world, and that once the Gulf War was over, we have to figure out a strategy and find an enemy that will continue to justify the large expense of the military budget and give us a global geopolitical strategy on which we can base our rule, our dominion of the world.
But you know, this is presented to the United States and the world in quite different terms, in terms of justice, in terms of the United Nations credibility, in terms of national security. I mean, we'll get to that. But you write of what you call the sublime complacence of those so certain of American virtue, truth, justice, and power. Well, is it so complacent?
Well,
I mean, who's the more just pole? Where do we turn if not to the United States?
Well, I mean, the United States, when I say sublime complacence, what I'm referring to are the writings of the people like Charles Krauthammer or the editors of the Weekly Standard or the editors of the National Review or some Dick Armitage, who's an undersecretary of defense, just the other day said there has been no power on earth since Rome to compare to the United States. We are the masters of all we see. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty much a direct quote. We not only have the military power, but we have the cultural power. The world looks at our movies, buys our products, admires our way of life, and so forth, and we are Rome. So there have been people saying these kinds of things increasingly in the last few years in Washington.
But could it not be true that even if one accepts that view, and of course many people would not, but even if one does, that the U.S. is Rome in the terms that it's not looking just to project high virtues, but to really project power, could it not still be that a country like Iraq, that a tyrant like Saddam Hussein might pose a true threat to global security, developing weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, nuclear. Isn't that a problem?
Yes, but that's a problem. You could say the same thing, not exactly the same thing, but it's a problem in Pakistan. I mean, we have a military dictator in Pakistan who actually has nuclear weapons under his control. We have nuclear powers, weapons in the hands of the Israelis, who are fighting a bloody insurrection with the Palestinians and have fought four wars with the Arabs over the last 20-odd years. We have nuclear weapons in the hands of the Chinese, about whom we know very little. Supposedly there are at least the beginning of a nuclear military establishment in North Korea. So if you go around saying, well, we're going to attack every nation that has nuclear weapons and presents a danger to the world, you would end up fighting quite a few wars at the same time. And we set ourselves up as the minister of the world's justice. On the other hand, we refused to join the world court. We've been making quite an issue of that question over the last 3 or 4 months, and we say that American peacekeepers, American soldiers must be granted immunity and exemptions from the possibility of being brought before a war crimes tribunal.
But when George Bush puts the pressure on, and here we are 5 days later after the UN speech, or four, and Baghdad is saying, we accept unconditionally inspections, isn't that a step toward security?
That might be, but the what you will see, you saw the story on the op-ed page of the New York Times this morning. Mm-hmm. A weapons inspector was saying that kind of a promise from Iraq means nothing because they can hide certainly the biological and the chemical weapons, that they are treacherous, their word can't be trusted, it means nothing. This is the position that the Bush administration has taken.
And will no doubt continue to take one way or another.
I suspect so, because if you remember the speech last Thursday, Bush didn't really say anything about weapons inspections.
It was one of his demands.
Disarmament was one of his demands, yes. Which is different from weapons inspection. And then he went on to talk about the other resolutions passed by the UN over the last 10 years, which include essentially reforming the government of Iraq and persuading Hussein to somehow transform Iraq into the state of Connecticut.
Or if not Hussein, then it would seem a successor. But some kind of reform seems like a good idea there, don't you think?
Sure, but I would think reform would be a good idea in Saudi Arabia.
And not necessarily a reason to go to war. Louis Lapham, please stand by. There's so many people who want to join this conversation. We're talking with Harper's Magazine editor Louis Lapham. Is the United States as blinded by its power as the ancient Athenians, or is it just doing its contemporary duty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. This is a very interesting historical comparison. Unfortunately, it's completely inapposite to the current situation, and I have to say I've been pretty amazed at the intellectual laziness that's been on display here. I do not think that anybody in the administration is taking an attack on Iraq lightly or not trying to think this through. If you think that there's been no debate on this issue, I question whether you've been reading any publications as opposed to just publishing your own. You know, in addition to that, I mean, the fact that there are other bad actors in the world, it doesn't mean that you have to take them all on at once.
Scott, can we go just to your historical point? Why do you not accept the parallel with the Athenian history?
Well, not just Athenian history, but Roman history. First of all, the Athenians, according to what your guest has been saying, one of their primary motives was that they were promised treasure by this colony, and that's not exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about regional stability, and we're talking about a threat to the United States and its allies.
But there is a little glimmer of oil beneath Iraq as well, isn't there?
Well, sure there is, absolutely, but that's not necessarily something that requires us to act against somebody who's actively attempting to acquire weapons of mass destruction or mass murder. So, you know, the fact that there might not be completely altruistic motives involved here doesn't mean that we should then say, well, we're going to sit back and hope for some kind of reform in Iraq, but the most that we're going to do on this is just hope for it.
Scott, let's put it to Lewis Lapham. Lewis Lapham, you hear the critique. What do you say?
Well, I don't understand his point about Thucydides, but I don't think Iraq does present that much of a threat to either the United States or its allies. As far as I'm concerned, or as far as I understand, it does not have the weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't have the means to deliver them. It doesn't have the money to make them.
But it has oil income. We're told
it
it's been importing. It's been importing elements required even for the development of nuclear weapon. And we heard last week, what was it, that 100 pounds of fissile material stands between Iraq and the possibility of a nuclear weapon within months. Doesn't that sound like a threat?
Well, I mean, if you read the international, that sounds to me like Bush administration propaganda. Because if you remember, a week ago, Saturday, Bush and Tony Blair stood up at Camp David and waved around a photograph of a weapons facility, a nuclear facility supposedly active in Iraq, and then tied it to an International Atomic Energy Commission report saying that the Iraq was capable of making nuclear weapons in a matter of months. And within 2 hours of that statement, the International Atomic Energy Commission issued its own statement saying that that was an entirely false interpretation of what the commission had said, that that Iraq was years away from making a nuclear weapon, and that the photograph that had been held up by Mr. Bush was 4 years old, not new, and that the facility that he was pretending existed as of today had been taken apart 4 years ago.
Scott, who's being led down the garden path here, Scott?
Well, I think it's clearly your guest, because in contravention to that particular example, I would point out that Iraq, for example, has said repeatedly that, gee, we're not developing biological weapons. We're not developing chemical weapons. And, in fact, inspectors were actually horrified to find out how close Iraq or how much capability Iraq had actually developed. We've also had situations where...
Wait a minute. They were horrified in 1991.
They're supposed to be farther behind now that we're 11 years beyond this.
They're much farther behind. If you read the reports of the UNSCOM people, that stuff has been taken down.
I'm sorry. I happen to know one of the inspectors on that.
So do
team,
I.
And that's, well, congratulations.
And we've seen inspectors, even at the high level of Scott Ritter and Hans Blix, disagreeing.
You get Butler and Ritter in the same conversation, and they sound like myself and your caller. I mean,
and yet, Lewis Lapham, you've got to concede it's hard to turn away. Only today on the wires I read another Iraqi scientist who left Iraq saying they have the German centrifuge equipment that could take them on the road to nuclear weapons. It's not a comforting picture, and Iraq has resisted with great guile over this decade a real thorough accounting of its weapons. Is there no point at which that requires intervention?
I think it requires inspection. And if you listen to the inspectors that I talk to, as to say Scott Ritter, they can do the job. I don't think it requires intervention, no.
Scott, thank you for your call. Jim's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Just a couple of very brief points. I think Osama bin Laden is going to have us where he wants us. He's going to have, if Saudi Arabia gives us access.
And they're saying today that they will, to their bases.
Right. This is where exactly where Osama bin Laden wants Saudi Arabia and us to be.
Why so? The last time we had those bases, he suffered a pretty nasty rout.
Who suffered?
Saddam Hussein did in the Gulf War.
Right. And you know what? The people, the street in the Middle East detest these potentates who just grovel to the United States and put their own people down. And this is what we are playing right into the trap of Osama bin Laden. I don't care about him either, and neither do I care for Saddam Hussein, but I do care about the innocent people who will be killed in this.
So do you think that the anger of Arabs who see this unfold is a greater threat than biological, chemical, nuclear weapons in Baghdad?
Well, that's, of course, assuming that what you say about biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons is correct.
It is, but nevertheless.
It is?
No, I'm saying it is assuming that there's a threat, but we're told repeatedly there is. It becomes hard to disbelieve it after a while.
Right. We begin praying it, the mantra. But let me tell you this. I think America is the best when it is, you know, engaged in commerce. And when you have a war, when you have people alienated with you in a region, this will slow down the growth of America, to say nothing about the immorality of it.
So stay away from war. Jim, thank you for your call. Lewis Lapham, at the very top of your article, The Road to Babylon, you quote Barbara Tuchman, and she talks about four kinds of misgovernment, fundamental kinds of misgovernment: tyranny, excessive ambition, incompetence or decadence, and folly or perversity. You say that this government, the Bush administration, is guilty of all four. That's a very sweeping charge.
Yeah.
Tyranny?
I'm sorry. I would it's probably too sweeping. I would say they were guilty of folly and incompetence. I whether or not they're guilty of excessive ambition, they might be. But that would be harder to establish. But certainly, and tyranny, I think, is too sweeping a statement. I think that Mr. Ashcroft and the Patriot Act tends toward repression and tends toward an erosion of the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, and endangers the liberties and freedoms of the American people. But I wouldn't say that it was yet had reached the stage of tyranny. On the other hand, incompetence is, it seems to me, would be a fair statement about the Bush administration.
And where do you see it? They've got unconditional acceptance of inspections now. We see arrests in the last couple of days of al-Qaeda people all over the place. Even as far off as Singapore, is there not evidence that something's going on here?
Well, we've declared a war on terrorism, and we have yet to find Osama bin Laden. We have yet to find Mullah Omar. We have yet to, again, if you believe what you read in the papers, we have yet to round up the leading figures in al-Qaeda. We don't know where, or so we say, we have no idea where the next blows are coming from. We seem to have alienated quite a few of our allies in Europe.
Or have. It's a lot to worry about. Lewis Lapham, please stand by. We've got to take another break. Is this war imperial overreach or wise stewardship of global security? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham, who stands foursquare against war with Iraq. And the question is the war path to Iraq a sign of American seriousness or of American arrogance? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Lewis Lapham, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation for just a moment Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author of Defending America, the Case for Limited National Missile Defense. Michael O'Hanlon, I hope you can bring us a little bit further up to date on the news we got just before the top of the hour that Iraq is indicating it's ready unconditionally to allow weapons inspectors back into the country. Is that what you're reading, and is that the case at the moment?
That's what I hear, too. I'm not sure I have any more news for you. I can give you the latest in Washington punditry speculation, however, which is that this is, of course, a good step, but it's only a step because this raises the obvious question of just how cooperative will Iraq really be. It makes it pretty clear that they're giving in to pressure, and they realize that our sword is hanging over their head in a pretty menacing position at the moment.
So is it a victory for the Bush administration or a complication for them if what they really want to have is regime change?
Well, you put your finger on it. There are people in the Bush administration who will like this outcome and people who won't. Rumsfeld and Cheney probably never wanted this kind of strategy with Mr. Bush giving his speech last week at the UN and proposing this ultimatum approach because they were afraid of the very outcome we're now getting. They were afraid that we would have to take yes for an answer to the demand on inspections. Others, probably Secretary Powell, are, I'm sure, encouraged by this, although everyone realizes this is probably just a first step. Again, Saddam may very well ultimately delay, obfuscate, obstruct, and just play for time with these inspections. So I'm not sure it's a victory yet, even for those who are happy to settle for inspections. But it's certainly a step in that direction, and it looks pretty good.
Is it actually a threat to the global coalition that Washington appeared suddenly last week after the UN speech to be in reach of pulling together? Might this break up the allies who will now say, hey, we agreed only if they don't have inspections. Now they're agreeing to inspections. Let's slow down here, America.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. In fact, there's almost no country in the world besides the United States that would even consider the use of military force at this point. Even Tony Blair, even the Kuwaitis are not going to want to go to war at this point. So in this sense, those who say that Saddam is stupid, I think, you know, they have, unfortunately, he is evil, but he is not stupid. And he realized that the politics of the UN were disfavorable to him as things were going, and he was better off stopping the momentum that we were developing before it got any more of a head of steam up. So at this point, Saddam has actually complicated Bush administration diplomacy, to go back to your earlier point, even though, in a way, the Bush administration is getting what it wants and deserves credit for having forced that kind of an outcome. So it's just a chapter. A chapter is ending tonight, or perhaps beginning, but even though it's been a good last hour or two of developments, it's by no means the final resolution of this crisis.
Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael O'Hanlon is senior fellow in policy studies at the Brookings Institution. We're talking tonight with Lewis Lapham about the case against war on Iraq. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Lewis Lapham, here's news breaking right beneath us. I've got to ask, I wonder if you were surprised at the speed with which, after President Bush's speech at the UN last week, all these reluctant one-time allies started quickly lining up, even unto today where we saw Saudi Arabia saying, okay, you can use our bases after all. Were you surprised that people seemed to be flipping so quickly on war with Iraq?
Yes, I was. I thought that I didn't think that Bush's speech was particularly convincing. There was no news in it, and the addition of the six further conditions at the end of the speech seemed to be even more bellicose and an expression that he, in fact, threatened the UN. He said, either you do what we want you to do here in Iraq, or you're irrelevant.
You are a new League of Nations.
Yeah. So he not only threatened Iraq, he threatened the UN itself, and I didn't think it was a persuasive speech
But
at
it
all.
Seems to have worked. Is that incompetence or is that leadership?
I don't know. It did surprise me. So, maybe that is a form of competence. I should say, by the way, on a question of incompetence, if you define what do you think a competent government is, you could then take that word and talk about it in terms of domestic policy, in terms of the domestic economy, health care, the environment.
And that's a great spectrum in itself. We're setting that aside for the moment. We're going to be talking about that next hour, actually. Lisa's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Welcome, Lisa. You're on the air with Lewis Lapham.
Hi. I'm very grateful to be on the air with Lewis Lapham, and I couldn't agree with him more. I'm actually a native to Syracuse, New York.
The other Syracuse.
Yeah. And
Where do you find your point of agreement, Lisa?
Well, I didn't find Bush's speech the least bit convincing, and I don't think that everyone rolled over because it was convincing. In order to have been truly convincing, he would have had to answer the many reasoned criticisms that have been, you know, written and discussed in recent weeks about, you know, the potential for destabilizing an already very unstable region, giving a green light to countries like India and Pakistan to preempt each other with weapons of mass destruction. You know, what comes after Saddam? All kinds of questions that were unanswered in that speech.
And what about the case that is made, that they are headed toward nuclear weapons and the international community has to stand up and fulfill the UN mission?
Well, you know, the quote of Andrew Card saying that they started to make their case in September because August isn't a good month to introduce a product, if everything is prefaced by that statement, it makes it difficult to listen to what's being told to us and hear it as anything other than, you know, Madison Avenue marketing.
You're feeling fully marketed to. Lisa, thank you for your call. Lewis Lapham, what about this point that Lisa raises, that there's the danger of destabilizing the whole region, but we hear that there are parties in Washington who would like to destabilize a bunch of this region, to shuffle the deck?
Yes. I mean, I've read those, or some of those analyses in the policy journals, people who say that our real enemy is Saudi Arabia, or that we would like to have firm control of the oil in Iraq as well as the oil in Kurdistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, and so forth. But I'm just not enough of a geopolitician, and nor do I know enough of what isn't said to make a clear judgment on that. Again, this strikes me as the kind of imperial thinking that has become popular in Washington in the last several years, that we have the power to shuffle the deck, as I've heard people say, in both Iran and Saudi Arabia. I'm not so sure we have that power.
We may well find out. Brian's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for your article. There's too few points of view like yours being put out in the media these days. One question, you make the point that it's against the United Nations Charter. Can you talk a little bit about the United States' position? On one hand, invoking the United Nations now that we seem to need it, and on the other hand, it seems to me, completely unraveling the precedent of international law by this preemptive strike and what that means for our security in the future when somebody else decides that they need a preemptive strike, and even using that argument to do something against the United States.
Lewis Lapham?
Well, I think that's a real concern. I mean, it's a bad precedent to set. I mean, already within the last few days, Putin in Russia has said, well, we will take the American rationale and argument vis-a-vis Iraq, and we will apply it to Chechnya. And where is the moral high ground on which we counter that argument?
And even neighboring Georgia, which has not been fighting with the Soviet Union or Russia.
Yes, no, that's right. I'm sorry. Also, to pursue the Chechenian rebels
into
Georgia. Mm-hmm. And then our refusal to be a party to the international court. In many ways, lawless behavior in the world. I mean, our overturning of the tariff agreements with regard to the steel tariff.
But in another light, Louis Lapham, isn't this exactly the kind of muscular policing of world peace that the UN originally imagined? That when the next Hitler came along, there would be a concert of nations that would nip it in the bud, and they'd have the international mechanism to do that.
Yes, but the point is concert of nations. That's your own phrase. In other words, the big problems in the world are all international, and none can be solved by any one country. I don't care how rich that one country is, but the big problems in the world are disease, environment, malnutrition, distribution of resources, and so forth. And they can only be addressed by some, as your term, concert of nations or international cooperative power. And it won't work. The military power doesn't solve much of anything. I mean, I think we have the example of that in Israel, where Sharon, again, has taken upon himself the doctrine of preemptive strike, forward deterrence, preemptive assassination, and it doesn't resolve the problem in Israel.
But can't you just hear the conservative bench saying, Louis Lapham, you're wrong. Yasser Arafat is now on the outs with his own parliament. We may be getting a better team in there at the Palestinian Authority, more democratic, less corrupt. Iraq is standing up now, ready to have weapons inspections after 4 or 5 years of resisting them at every turn.
Yeah, but I think these things play out over time. I mean, we could have said the same thing about the wonderful Shah of Iran. I mean, we would have been saying these same kind of things about the wonderful Saddam Hussein during the war, his war with Iran, when we supplied him with chemical weapons. We were saying these wonderful things about Osama bin Laden when he was working for the CIA in the middle 1980s in Afghanistan. We were saying these wonderful things about Noriega.
Until we didn't.
The hero of Panama. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of over what period of time do you measure those kinds of remarks? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I guess it is. Brian, I want to thank you for your call. And Lisa, before that, let's get one more call. Suzanne's calling from Norton, Massachusetts. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air.
Yes. I was very interested in an early statement that Mr. Lapham made about the fact that this country is now more an oligarchy than a democracy. Because it's not going from the bottom up, it's going from the top down. And I think that we should try and get back to the fact that Congress has to declare war. Congress is the representatives of the people. I know we've had wars, we've been doing this without declaring war, but I think we should try and see how this country could get back to that.
And plenty of presidents have stepped in. Louis Lapham, if I heard you, I think what you said was that ancient Athens turned away from democracy and toward oligarchy after the failure of its Sicilian campaign.
Yeah.
Oligarchy.
Yes, I think if democracies have a tendency to turn into either tyrannies or oligarchies unless people are very careful. And democracy is the hardest form of government because it requires a high degree of literacy and a high degree of participation on the part of the people. And as you said earlier in this show, the difficulty here is there's so little debate in the Congress, which is where it ought to be taking place. I mean, O'Hanlon makes the interesting point that there's an argument going on within the Bush administration, but there's Your last caller is correct. It is from the top down. I mean, I go around the country or I talk to people I know who are not either in the media or in the government, and they are not particularly keen for the imperial war in Iraq.
Suzanne,
sorry.
No, I'm sorry, Lestat. I just wanted to thank Suzanne and get one more question to you, if I could, before we go. That is, in your article, you say that what you see essentially in the Bush administration is a fear of the future. It's unfair. We've only got 40 seconds, but what do you mean by that? Fear of the future.
A fear of the future that is not American. I mean, an unwillingness to, I mean, so much of their language and so many of their ideas are firmly rooted in the past. I mean, much of the, as at least as I hear it, of the rhetoric and of the war planning strikes me as something that's coming out of the old Cold War. An unwillingness to imagine how the world might be different.
Louis Lefham, our time is up. We hope you keep imagining that, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Louis Lefham is editor of Harper's Magazine. His article, The Road to Babylon, appears in this current issue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBU.